You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is The Compound, what the Fed already knew about the remedies its most celebrated investor prescribes. On March 31, 2026, Warren Buffett sat down with Becky Quick in Omaha, Nebraska for his first CNBC Squawk Box interview since stepping down as Berkshire Hathaway's chief executive. The occasion was notable by any measure. Berkshire holds more than $350 billion in Treasury bills, a position large enough to register in Treasury auction data and broad market surveillance. When that man speaks about monetary policy, bond markets listen, legislators take notes, and the institution itself operates in the environment his cash allocation helps define. The interview covered a wide range of ground: tariffs, the economy, Berkshire's succession, but Buffett kept returning to the Federal Reserve. He spoke with the authority of someone who has watched the institution across six decades of rate cycles, crises, and recoveries. He had seen what happens when the Fed hesitates and what happens when it moves. He had formed a clear theory. The central bank's primary obligation is stability. Inflation is a compounding threat that destroys the living standards of ordinary Americans, and the two greatest Fed chairmen of the modern era were the ones who understood this most viscerally. His case for Powell was direct and specific. In March 2020, Buffett argued, the Federal Reserve confronted a cascade that could have consumed the financial system within weeks. Once the dominoes start toppling, they just start toppling, and that line is shorter than anybody thinks, and it topples faster. The Fed moved, and the cascade stopped. His assessment was unequivocal. I think he did exactly the right thing, and he did it even stronger than Volcker did. You know, I mean, he and Volcker are my heroes at the Fed. Two heroes, one sentence, a framework for what the institution is for. These are testable claims. The archive can evaluate each one. We went into the archives. The borrowed lineage. Buffett joins two chairmen in a single sentence, framing the highest expression of Federal Reserve courage as a shared tradition. Testing that pairing requires establishing first what the archive actually shows Volcker to have been, because the comparison is not, as it might initially appear, historically indefensible. Buffett's formulation is precise. He and Volcker are my heroes at the Fed, with Powell having acted even stronger than Volcker did. The pairing implies a common tradition, that both men faced cascading systemic risk and answered with decisive force. That textual foothold exists. Volcker was not simply the chairman who accepted mass unemployment to break inflation. He was also, when the moment demanded it, a lender of last resort who understood that monetary discipline had a systemic limit. When Continental Illinois National Bank collapsed in 1984, Volcker described what the Federal Reserve did without equivocation. The institution, acting as lender of last resort, provided large amounts of funds through the discount window to maintain the bank's liquidity, with peak lending exceeding $7 billion. His account of why intervention was warranted carried the language of urgency. From the Paul A. Volcker, it is this potential for cascading liquidity pressures, undermining the stability of the financial system, that has demanded prompt and forceful action by governments, as well as by private institutions, to protect the stability of the financial system as a whole and our own economy. Cascading pressures, forceful action, system-saving urgency. The vocabulary maps onto March 2020 without distortion. Buffett's reading is not absurd. But Volcker's Continental Illinois actions were embedded within a framework that depended on something the 2020 intervention deliberately avoided: pain as the active transmission mechanism. Governor Henry Wallach described the logic in February 1981. From the Henry Wallach: we have no magic way of getting from a low growth of the money supply to lower wages and lower prices, except via low capacity utilization and high unemployment.
The discount window support for Continental Illinois was a firebreak, not a bypass. It was reactive, bounded, and directed at maintaining the liquidity of a single institution while a resolution was developed. The disciplines remained in force alongside it. The $7 billion figure represented targeted liquidity for a single institution, not an absorption of private credit risk across entire asset classes. The 2020 intervention sits differently in the archive. In the March 15th emergency call, Neil Kashkari asked whether consideration had been given to making asset purchases unlimited, framing that option as the more powerful signal. What followed confirmed the logic. Corporate bond purchases, municipal lending facilities, and credit support extended to entities with no prior Federal Reserve relationship. The Teal Book later documented that investment-grade and speculative-grade corporate bond issuance had been sustained by the Fed's willingness to purchase individual bonds, a broad backstop to private credit markets, including the direct purchase of corporate bonds that operated through the announcement channel as much as through realized transactions. Public communications framed all of this as continuous with the lender of last resort mandate Volcker had invoked for Continental Illinois. The internal record showed the institution understood the qualitative difference. Reactive discount window liquidity for a single failing bank versus an unlimited, proactive willingness to backstop private credit markets across entire asset classes. A qualitative departure from the discount window model Volcker had deployed. Staff acknowledged the latter carried moral hazard consequences. Volcker's framework would have flagged as corrosive to the disciplines that made his medicine effective in the first place. The assay examined a parallel dynamic in a different context. Judy Shelton borrowed Volcker's authority to authorize prescriptions his own documented philosophy would have opposed. The pattern is not unique to that episode. Volcker's name is invoked most confidently where his framework would dissent most sharply. Read through the archive rather than the biography, the two men Buffett joins as heroes stand at markedly different positions on the scope and scale of permissible intervention, a trade-off the institution itself agonized over, and what holds together the rest of his framework when the foundation of that pairing dissolves is the question that now requires an answer. The buffer. Buffett's two Fed heroes are separated by a qualitative rupture the institution itself recognized. Reactive liquidity for a single failing bank versus unlimited proactive credit risk absorption. But the more fundamental pressure point in his framework is what he wishes had never happened. The decision to target 2% inflation rather than zero. "I wish they had a zero inflation target," he told Becky Quick, framing the 2% threshold as an institutional failure, a compounding drag on savers, a structural guarantee that anyone earning less than the target rate goes backwards in real terms. The diagnosis has surface plausibility. The prescription is what the archive dismantles. The 2% target was built on convergent staff research, though the precise level was debated, and some participants acknowledged an element of pragmatism in the choice. Mishkin, among others, observed that the committee had a habit of drawing the target first and constructing the rationale around it. What the internal record does establish is that two load-bearing analytical components, each supported by staff research, made zero institutionally untenable, regardless of where exactly the positive target landed. Douglas Elmendorf, presenting to the FOMC in February 2005, named the architecture directly. From the Douglas Elmendorf. "The chief rationales for positive true inflation are downward nominal wage rigidity and the zero lower bound on nominal interest rates. Two rationales, neither about tolerance for price increases. The second is decisive here. The zero lower bound means the Fed cannot cut its policy rate below roughly zero in a crisis, and the space available for conventional easing is bounded from above by wherever the rate stands when the shock arrives." Staff research quantified that ceiling. A January 2005 FRB US memo concluded, "From the board staff, FRB US analysis, the basic conclusion of the FRB US analysis, specifically, that a cushion of about 1 percentage point on the bias-adjusted inflation rate would provide adequate protection for the risks posed by the zero lower bound, is supported by research using other models. 1 percentage point of ZLB insurance." To that, staff added the measurement bias component. CPI systematically overstates true inflation. And David Stockton told the committee in 1996 that a range roughly of 1/2 to 1.5% is still a reasonable estimate for the measurement bias. The measure documented how that same measurement gap, the distance between what the chosen gauge reports and what households experience, functions as an institutional design choice with distributional consequences the public framework never disclosed. The decomposition is internally consistent with the staff logic. Roughly 1 point for bias correction, roughly 1 point for crisis response cushion, stacked to approximately 2. That arithmetic does not uniquely derive 2. The CPI-based bias estimates Stockton cited do not translate 1-for-1 into a PCE inflation objective, and the FRB US memo framed its cushion recommendation as a range rather than a precise additive term. What the internal record does establish is that both components pointed toward a positive target, that the magnitudes were roughly consistent with the number the committee eventually adopted, and that 0 was excluded by the logic rather than merely disfavored by it. The decomposition explains why the flaw held where it did. It is a plausible account of the engineering, not a documented derivation of the exact figure. The internal debate was vigorous. Jeffrey Lacker, president of the Richmond Fed, argued in 2007 that the correct number was lower. "I believe 1% would be our best choice for a numerical inflation objective. I believe 1.5% would be tolerably close to price stability. But I view 2% as incompatible with our price stability mandate." His dissent is instructive precisely for what it does not contest. Lacker disputed the magnitude of the cushion, not the existence of the engineering logic. The 0 lower bound as a necessary design input had no opponents at the table. Even the strongest internal voice against 2% accepted the framework that makes 0 institutionally untenable. When the committee issued its public statement in January 2012, formally adopting the target, that analytical scaffolding, the measurement bias arithmetic, the ZLB frequency modeling, the rejected alternatives at 0%, 1%, and 1.5% did not appear. The public received a considered judgment. It did not receive the decades of stress testing that made the number load-bearing. Which brings the contradiction into exact focus. In March 2020, the Fed deployed 150 basis points of rate cuts in 11 days. The intervention Buffett described as even stronger than Volcker's. That cutting room existed because the 2% target had maintained nominal rates above the 0 lower bound when the shock arrived. Under a 0 inflation target, nominal rates at equilibrium would track the real neutral rate. And where that rate is low, as it has been for much of the post-crisis period, the conventional cutting room available when a shock arrives compresses toward the 0 lower bound. The buffer Buffett would destroy is the precondition for the heroism he praises. His two strongest convictions, that Powell's intervention was exactly right and that the inflation target should be 0, exist in deep tension. A 0 objective would substantially increase the probability of ELB constraint and reduce the conventional rate-cutting space that gave Powell's intervention its initial velocity. The prescriptive framework has collapsed on its own internal logic. What remains is whether the diagnostic instinct beneath it, Buffett's reading of how the crisis unfolded and why the Fed's response succeeded, survives the wreckage of the prescription. The dominoes. The diagnostic instinct that has survived the wreckage of Buffett's prescriptions is the one rooted in pattern. He reads cascades. Once the dominoes start toppling, they just start toppling, and that line is shorter than anybody thinks, and it topples faster. The image is precise in a way that institutional frameworks rarely manage. Not merely that financial panics accelerate, but that the window for effective intervention compresses faster than any deliberative body can measure. The archive provides, across 4 decades of crisis transcripts, the most substantial confirmation of Buffett's worldview available in the documentary record. The 1987 evidence is the deepest. On October 20th, as equity markets recorded their largest single-day decline in history, E. Gerald Corrigan, then president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the institution's most practiced reader of systemic stress, told his colleagues something that the public narrative of that episode's successful resolution has since obscured. From the "just because we have not seen hard evidence of any sizable or troubling losses, obviously that doesn't mean that they may not be there. It's quite clear that a lot of people are not entirely sure where they are." Real-time uncertainty about losses, while the cascade was already running. 11 years later, the same structural lag appeared in compressed form. Governor Roger Ferguson reported to the committee during the LTCM episode, not that markets were deteriorating, but that they had already crossed a threshold the committee had not yet processed. "The financial markets do seem to be showing signs of a great deal of fear and uncertainty. They seem actually to have gone beyond a state of concern and uncertainty and to have seized up in important ways." Gone beyond. Already. By 2008, the pattern had sharpened into measurable alarm. William Dudley, then SOMA manager with the most direct real-time view of market functioning, assessed conditions in a conference call 10 days after Lehman's collapse, before Congress had acted at all. "Obviously, this is an extremely fragile and dangerous environment. I am struck by the feeble market response to the substantial escalations implemented over the past 10 days. Feeble response to substantial escalation, measured before a single congressional vote on TARP. This sequence dismantles Buffett's framing directly. When Bernanke announced that the Treasury would dedicate $250 billion toward purchases of preferred shares in banks and thrifts of all sizes, the capital injection instrument was not improvised from congressional wreckage. It was the structurally superior design that the original asset purchase framework had always lacked. The rejection forced the better tool." What the three-tiered archive confirms is the precise dynamic Buffett sensed without naming, and the divergence between registers is itself the finding. Across episodes, senior institutional principals recognized systemic severity in real time during deliberative calls, with that internal awareness consistently running ahead of public messaging. The institution possessed awareness without velocity. It was not blind. Corrigan saw the hidden risks in 1987. Ferguson felt the seizure in 1998. Dudley measured the escalation failures in 2008. That the response speed varied across episodes matters. 1987 saw rapid, coordinated liquidity provision, and by 2020, the Fed's real-time monitoring had improved markedly over the prior crisis. The pattern is not one of uniform institutional failure, but of a recurring structural lag. What deliberative governance cannot do, in any of these episodes, is match the speed at which a phone stops being answered. The diagnostic instincts are sound, and the archive says so. But every valid diagnosis Buffett offers leads toward the same prescriptive destination. The conviction that follows most naturally from the evidence, that stability, made paramount, would prevent the dominoes from lining up at all. The hierarchy. Buffett's most sympathetic claim, "If I were at the Fed, the thing I'd worry about always is the stability of the banks," is the destination every valid diagnosis he has offered points toward. The archive confirms the diagnosis before it addresses the prescription.
That remark admits at least 3 readings. The weakest is supervisory vigilance. That bank soundness should be a standing priority for the institution's regulatory and examination functions. A reading post-2008 reforms have substantially implemented through enhanced capital requirements, liquidity standards, and stress testing. A second reading is the crisis lending doctrine, tested in the borrowed lineage. That systemic fragility justifies forceful lender of last resort action when cascades begin. the reading most consistent with Buffett's praise of both heroes. The third and strongest reading is that stability should be formally paramount as a policy objective. Governing rate decisions and the institutional mandate hierarchy in a way that displaces the conventional dual mandate balance. The Post tests this third reading because it is the one with policy consequences the archive can evaluate, and because Buffett's framing, worry about stability always, not merely in crisis, invites it. The weaker readings are not ignored. The first is already largely the institutional reality, and the second was addressed in the preceding section. What follows concerns whether the strongest reading survives deliberate examination. The claim that the banking system is simultaneously strong and fragile is not rhetorical hedging. It is the Fed's own finding. Post-crisis reforms materially strengthened the regulated banking perimeter. Capital buffers rose. Liquidity requirements were formalized. Stress tests created a supervisory feedback mechanism that did not exist before 2008. But the internal record on where systemic risk went next is unambiguous. Loretta Mester, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, named the structural principle in April 2016. From the Loretta Mester: taking an action that pushes risk away from one set of institutions to another doesn't eliminate the risk. It just lets it move around, potentially to a part of the financial system in which the risk is more difficult to monitor and to control. Risk migrated. It did not compress. Bernanke, as chairman, had already identified in 2011 the specific topology it was migrating toward. The centralization of clearing and settlement in clearinghouses produced the concentration of substantial financial and operational risk in a small number of organizations, a development he described as carrying potentially important systemic implications. Richard Fisher, during the September 2008 conference call, traced the even longer arc. Emergency interventions, however necessary, were creating larger and larger concentrations and expanding the universe of institutions too large to permit to fail. Public communications led with the success narrative: capital stronger, system more resilient, stress tests passed. The internal record documented a structural transformation of fragility rather than its elimination. Buffett's diagnostic instinct, therefore, survives the archive scrutiny. The system carries concentrated, interconnected risk of the kind he describes. His conclusion, that stability should be the paramount Fed concern, displacing the conventional dual mandate balance, follows naturally from the diagnosis. That conclusion is also precisely what three decades of sustained internal deliberation found to be self-defeating. Staff analyses documenting the mechanism, the risk-taking channel, by which a stability-first mandate incentivizes moral hazard, were filtered from public communications to avoid signaling a framework shift. The institution thought deeply about this question and kept most of that thinking internal. That internal thinking had a consistent finding. Donald Cohn, as vice chairman, named the mechanism directly. From the Donald L. Cohn: in general, I think those dual objectives, promoting financial stability and avoiding the creation of moral hazard, are best reconciled by central banks focusing on the macroeconomic objectives of price stability and maximum employment.
A central bank that signals stability as its paramount commitment tells every participant in the financial system that concentrated risk-taking will be underwritten. That signal incentivizes the very concentration and leverage that generates systemic fragility. The Fed's interventions become anticipated rather than extraordinary. Rescue becomes expectation. Buffett's prescription, applied faithfully,
manufactures the condition it means to prevent. Janet Yellen, as chair, articulated the binding constraint in July 2014. This possibility does not obviate the need for monetary policy to focus primarily on price stability and full employment. The costs to society in terms of deviations from price stability and full employment that would arise would likely be significant. The archive tested this logic across Continental Illinois, LTCM, the GFC, and the post-Dodd-Frank macroprudential debates. Each episode returned the dominant internal position to the same finding. The debate was not without genuine dissent. Brainard argued that financial stability functioned as an implicit third leg of the Fed's mandate, integral to it, not merely auxiliary. And Baxter contended that Dodd-Frank's express assignment of systemic risk responsibilities placed stability within the institution's legal obligations rather than outside them. These were not marginal positions, and the institution never fully resolved the tension they introduced. What the record does establish is that the dominant leadership view, the position that shaped actual framework decisions, held that making stability paramount rather than integral was self-defeating. It would generate the moral hazard that produces the instability it means to prevent. The dual mandate's credibility, including the inflation target Buffett would eliminate, is the precondition for the Fed's authority to intervene at the scale he celebrates in both his heroes. Remove that credibility, and the framework that made Volcker's disinflation and Powell's March 2020 intervention possible dissolves with it. The institution ran the experiment, documented what it produces, and built its current framework on what survived the testing. The man in Omaha holds $350 billion in Treasury bills, a position that is itself a compound, decades of correct judgment, accumulated and reinvested, the arithmetic of patience made legible on a balance sheet. The framework he brought to the interview follows the same logic. Diagnose the mechanism early, name the cascade, and the prescription follows. The archive found the diagnoses largely sound. Buffett reads cascades correctly. His account of March 2020 matches what the Fed's own staff documented. The domino sequence, the speed, the necessity of overwhelming response. His conviction that inflation is a compounding threat to ordinary living standards is one the institution shares in language that predates the interview by decades. His instinct that bank stability deserves structural priority is exactly the hierarchy the Fed rebuilt its supervisory architecture around after 2008. What the archive could not confirm was the destination those diagnoses were meant to reach. Zero inflation as an anchor collapses under the same arithmetic Buffett applies to investment returns, tested, measured, and found to produce the deflationary rigidity the institution documented across multiple historical episodes of nominal constraint. The Volcker-Powell pairing holds biographically, but fractures at the qualitative rupture the Fed itself recognized. $7 billion in reactive liquidity against a system requiring multiples of that figure daily. Stability made paramount, tested as a governing principle, was found to require the very interventions Buffett would have preferred never to have been necessary. The compound interest that built Berkshire and the compounding inflation Buffett decries are governed by the same arithmetic. The institution understood that arithmetic before the prescription arrived. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.